Hi, I'm Stacey Shoemaker-Rowan, Editor-in-Chief of Hospitality Design Magazine, with HD's What I've Learned podcast. Today, I talk to Danish Karani. The inspiring architect is not only rethinking the design of our educational institutions, but innovating the entire concept as well. A true disruptor, Danish has a simple mission: to build projects with empathy and humanity by unabashedly challenging the status quo. Whether he's spearheading enriching designs for Google's Code Next STEM Lab in Oakland, California, Black Girls Code in New York, or the upcoming Riverbend School in India, Danish says he wants to solve society's greatest problems with socially aware, inclusive, and democratic design solutions. We are using design for good, he says, to build things that make people's lives better. Hi, I'm here with Danish. Danish, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Stacey.
So we always like to start at the beginning. Where did you grow up? Tell us a little bit about your childhood.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, I was born in Karachi, Pakistan, and we immigrated to the U.S. when I was about 3 years old. So I grew up outside of Atlanta, just in the suburbs. And, you know, nothing special, just a typical suburban Georgia. And you know, that's where I spent my childhood and until I left for college.
Got it. And did you always like design as a kid, or building things, or anything that kind of pointed to the career trajectory that you have?
Yeah, totally. You know, as a kid, I was going to my parents' dry cleaning business with them as a, you know, 7, 8, 9 year old. And I would just be in the back while they were handling customers out front. I was back there with cardboard boxes from, you know, hangers and shirt boxes. And I was building robots and mechanical things. And, you know, as a kid, they also got me Legos. We didn't have that much money, but, you know, they splurged on getting me Legos whenever I wanted, really. So I was building castles and desert islands and all sorts of things. And, you know, even art, I sold my first piece of art, or I guess my first art commission, was as a second grader.
Oh, wow.
I had a classmate who, he wanted me to draw him the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for, and so, you know, I charged him 25 cents, and that was my first art sell. So,
so was art something that you did a lot of, or was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles just just the first request?
Well, I was constantly drawing as a kid. That was the first request, certainly. But, you know, I was drawing all sorts of cartoon characters and sports cars and sneakers and, you know, drawings of Michael Jordan and other athletes, and just constantly drawing things. And then, you know, that went on even through high school. And so it was really, you know, I guess you could call it the beginnings of, you know, my love and appreciation for design was through art. You know, I was also a big science nerd. I mean, I loved learning about space and biology. And even, you know, I can remember in middle school, I think we had this, you know, we had this thing called mock trial, where you dress up and you review cases, and you have to go like pretend to like do a trial in a real courthouse in our town. And I was on the prosecution team, and I was sitting in the courthouse, and, you know, of course I'm supposed to be presenting soon, or, you know, arguing my case, and supposed to be watching like what the defense is doing. And instead of paying attention, I was looking at, you know, the Doric columns inside the courthouse, and just like marveling at the space that I was sitting in. And I think, you know, even from that young age, like I started to just be really cognizant and aware of my surroundings. You know, even, you know, when I was 8 years old, like we went back to Pakistan, to Karachi, where I was born. And I remember like very quickly, like I just, as an 8 year old, like I figured out how to navigate around the neighborhood. Like I could walk myself to like the candy shop that was like a mile away. And like, you know, I somehow, like even since I was a child, I could basically see the world from above. Like I could just map out an aerial view of anywhere. And so, yeah, like I think there were so many things in my childhood where it was all pointing towards, okay, like he's going to be an architect, or like he's going to be in design somehow. Yeah. And I had I guess, you know, my parents, you know, a lot of immigrant parents, especially South Asians, they're really pushing their kids of, you know, these traditional routes of like, okay, we've just come to America. Like, what's a safe bet? Well, you know, you're going to be a doctor, you're going to be a lawyer, you're going to be an accountant, you're going to be an engineer. And not many immigrant parents are willing to, I guess, let their kids take a risk and go into a design profession. But mine did, you know, they trusted me and they saw that innate interest and ability.
Yeah, no. And I loved the story that we did on you in our July issue. I love that you entered a design competition at your mosque at the age of 12 and created a rec center where kids in Karachi could play safely. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So my mosque, this was in our Sunday school, and we were learning about the Aga Khan Award for Architecture, which of course celebrates, you know, architectural projects that serve Muslim communities and really uplift the quality of life for individuals. And so as part of that competition, you know, we learned about the award, we learned about what it stood for. And that was probably one of the first times I learned that architecture can positively impact people's lives. And, you know, rightfully so, like all my classmates, they ran off and they were designing hospitals and schools. And, you know, and of course, these are all noble things that help individuals. And for me, I called on a very personal experience, which was just, you know, 4 or 5 years before that trip that I mentioned to Karachi when I was 8 years old, that, you know, I'd seen my cousin Murad and his friends. They were only like 2 years older than me. So these were like 10-year-old boys, like playing in the busy streets of Karachi. They were out there playing cricket. They just, you know, it's an urban city. Like there wasn't much land. There wasn't that many places for them to play, especially when you're not rich. And so they're out there risking their lives to play the game that they love. And, you know, they've got like rickshaws flying by and cars and even like animals in the streets. And so, you know, I decided, look, like these kids in Karachi, like, let me design something where they can play safely. Like all kids deserve to be able to play. And so let's build a rec center. And so, you know, this was like really sort of like pre-internet usage. You know, I was using like Encyclopedia and Encarta, you know, the CDs, like popping them into my computer, compact computer, and figuring out, okay, well, like what's the native plant species in Karachi, like in that part. Okay, it's banyan trees. Okay, we're going to line with banyan trees. And okay, what are the dimensions of like a cricket field and these other sports? And, you know, like getting like chart paper and meticulously, like with a, you know, long edge ruler, like drawing and charting out this design. And I lost the competition.
Oh, no.
But that's fine. You know, in fact, I still have that design to this day. Like it's still my house. I'd say, you know, it was my first architectural design. And it just so happens that the very first one I did was also focused on social impact. And so it's okay that I didn't win the competition because, you know, it was a great start. It really got me interested in architecture.
Yeah. And I think it, you know, speaks to where you ended up, which is kind of amazing. Not many people's careers past start at the age of 12 and then, you know, continue down the road. So we'll get to that. But so you decided to go study to be an architect at Rice University, right? And then Harvard?
That's right. Yep. I did undergraduate, a bachelor's of architecture at Rice, and then a master's of architecture and urban design at Harvard.
Wow. And did school help cement your love for architecture, or, you know, what was kind of the, I mean, obviously you went on to get your master's, but, you know, what was it that, you know, even made you have more of a love for architecture through your studies?
Well, I think both schools were quite good at teaching you to think about the impact architecture can have. You're not just designing or building for the sake of building. I mean, there's enough crap being produced in the world, yep. Right? And so both schools, I think, did a good job of pointing you towards societal problems that you could address through architecture. I would say I probably got even more of it while I was at Harvard GSD because I was older and could really think about that more. I didn't have to learn the craft when I was at the GSD. You know, when I was at Rice in undergrad, you're still learning line weights and you're still learning how to draw a section. You're still learning about sun, you know, solar orientations and wind patterns. You're still learning the craft of like how to design. So, you know, at that point you are somewhat designing for the sake of designing because you've just got to learn that. So even the last project at Rice was an international embassy in Dubai. And the goal was that the building itself would create dialogue and foster goodwill and collaboration and partnership amongst countries, that the environment, that the physical surroundings that these delegates and members of the embassy were in, that could actually push them to speak to countries and forge alliances and do, you know, things that they typically wouldn't. And so, you know, I think in your early years, when you're learning the craft, it's hard to then at the same time be applying that to good. But as soon as you feel comfortable, now I know how to draw all of the drawings, now I understand how to deal with the elements, then you could start to apply it and say, okay, well, now how do I use these skills for good? How do I start tackling the types of projects that mean something to me, you know, regardless of like whether your professors had assigned it to you or not. Now you can go off and say, okay, now I know how to design. Now let me start building stuff that's good for the world.
Yeah. No, amazing. And after school, you worked for two greats, Richard Meier and KPF. What was it like being in those architecture firms, and how did you continue to, you know, hone your craft?
Well, so, you know, after Rice and before Harvard is when I worked at both Meier's office and KPF. And I think, you know, I learned at Meier's office, I learned how to put together a great drawing set. You know, they are so meticulous about detailing. But on the other hand, you know, I also learned that I wasn't a formalist, which is probably a good thing, you know, but it didn't matter where we were putting a building. Like I remember I was working on a project, in a small town, you know, sort of very traditional environment, and we were just dropping in this white metal panel church, and you know, complete spaceship being dropped in the middle of town, and you know, people were not happy about it. And I remember asking my boss at the time, like, you know, hey, why are we doing it this way? And he said, you know, I was referring to the aesthetics, and he said, well, that's just how we do things. And so I realized having this like style wasn't for me. Like I felt like that prevents you from actually doing good architecture when you have this really strong style and you push the aesthetics no matter what, then you're not really taking into account regional variations in climate. You're not taking into account local materials, local building practices, local knowledge. You know, you're sort of like turning your back to that. And so I think it actually produces subpar architecture when you do that. So, you know, at the same time, like I learned how to draw and put together a great set. And it also helped me realize, okay, I don't want to be a formalist. And, you know, at KPF, I think, you know, that they do so many projects. And I had the luxury of being involved in a couple, and quite large teams. I could say that I met a few really great people at KPF. The work, you know, I found it not to be the most interesting, but I met some great people. And in fact, we would work on competitions together. So, you know, the New York, you know, as you know, like in the design world, New York sort of typical work week is, you know, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., right? You're on the grind. And so, you know, we would put in our 60, 70 hours a week. And then, you know, on nights, like starting at 9 p.m. and going till 2 in the morning, we'd be working on competitions for ourselves. And it's because I was working on things that mattered, that meant something to me, you know, that were truly meaningful. And so, you know, those experiences really solidified for me. Like, yeah, this is, you know, that feeling, that high that you're on when you're working on stuff that really matters. And you feel like you're doing good for the world. You know, it's those years in New York when I was at KPF and working on all these competitions on the side where I really felt that.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And did you decide to go then, I guess, back to Harvard then to kind of continue that that trajectory? Or why did you decide to stop working and go back to school?
Well, I think for me, you know, it was for a couple of reasons. Like one, it was my escape out of the corporate world. Yeah. Like it was my escape plan to just find a way out of there. It's like, okay, like this will be some structure or some other thing that I can go to. I don't think the corporate world really suited me, especially not sort of toxic corporate New York world, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it was, okay, I'm going to get out of here. I was interested in the urban design scale. So I thought, okay, let me learn more about that scale. I also suspected at that age that I'd want to teach at some point in my life. So I figured, you know, might as well get a terminal degree, and go ahead and get that master's. I did want to continue learning. I mean, obviously there's this great feeling that you get from learning and deliberately learning. You know, you're literally going somewhere every day to learn. And so, you know, I did want that experience. And, I finished up my licensure while I was in grad school. You know, I got all my tests out of the way, and, you know, it was right after Harvard that I launched my practice.
Yeah. And what did you want your practice to be? What was your hope when you started?
So from day one, I wrote this down for myself, that a couple of things. That one, I wanted to solve society's biggest problems, the world's biggest ailments. So that's education, poverty, food and water scarcity, environmental crises, homelessness, even cultural and ethnic sort of clashes and intolerance, you know, all of the things that like really were ailing the world. Those are the things that I wanted to help solve through architecture. And the other thing that I wanted to do with the firm was demonstrate to the general public, to global leaders, that, hey, architects should be at these conversation tables when you are getting together to solve these problems, right? Because like, if you think about, let's say homelessness in America, even when government agencies are getting together and saying, okay, let's try to tackle this problem, who are they bringing in? They're bringing in economists. They're bringing in, you know, CEOs from, Fortune 500 companies. They're bringing in, obviously HUD's a part of that. They're bringing in, maybe contractors. I doubt that. I suspect there's not really anyone from the AEC industry that's a part of those conversations. And so, you know, or let's take sustainability, for example, right? Both with the housing crisis and climate change, architects play such a big role. Like the amount of time and money it takes to build a building, the amount of emissions that come out of a building and energy usage, like architects are part of the problem, and yet like we're rarely called in to be a part of the solution. So, you know, one of the things that I wanted to demonstrate was, hey, we can actually help. We can be partners in this. We can help you create solutions, because frankly, like, the built environment that we've helped create over the last couple thousand years isn't that great. And so we should be the ones helping remedy this.
Yeah. No, for sure. It's such a big undertaking, though. So where do you even start? Like, what was your first part of your game plan?
Well, you know, in architecture school, like we don't really learn much about business. Like you have that one professional practice class where some lawyer like just scares the shit out of you of like, these are the million ways like you as an architect can get sued. But it's not really like, hey, here's like sound business strategy, you know? And so for me, it was, I just kind of looked around at what was happening. So I remembered, for example, Amazon. You know, when they started, they didn't say, well, we're just going to be a marketplace for everything. They said, we're going to sell books. We're going to be the best online bookstore you've ever seen. And in fact, our online bookstore is going to surpass physical bookstores in convenience and price and all these other things. And then they expanded into everything, right? And then they took over the world, right? And so so for me, it made sense from a business standpoint to start with one thing, get really good at it. And so I decided that should be education. And the reason I picked education was for so many of the problems that we have, whether it is poverty and food and water scarcity, inequality, lack of inclusion, climate change, all of these things, I feel like we're very reactive as a society. Like the problem pops up, it has to grow to like catastrophic proportions. And then we say, oh my God, like we need to do something about this. in my mind, so whatever we do for those things is reactive, but I always see education as this proactive thing, that if we have an educated world, like if every person in the world have access to a good quality education, we wouldn't create these problems to begin with. And I've had people say, look, Danish, you know, we've got people that go to the top business schools in the world and they come out and they're white collar criminals. Like, just because you have an education doesn't mean you're going to be a good person. But I think that's, I have a different definition of education. Like, when I talk about it, it's not just you're book smart and street smart, but you're learning how to be a good human. You're getting that ethics education, like good morals are instilled in you. Like, education to me means, like, how do you live as a human in a positive way? How do you be a, you know, how are you a good global citizen? And so learning all of that. So that's why I always think, if we can get everyone that, if we can get everyone that type of education, then we're not going to have these problems. We're going to create fewer problems for ourselves.
Yeah, no, completely. So what was your first quote unquote education project?
So I did a couple while at Harvard. I had a couple of funded research projects. You know, I think I did three while I was there in that 2 year span. So a research team and I went down to Brazil. We worked with the Ministry of Education in Rio de Janeiro. We helped them plan how to add schools and education infrastructure into the favelas down there. So, you know, they had favelas as large as 200,000-300,000 people that weren't getting these civil services. And so, you know, we were doing a lot of urban planning and mapping and planning out where schools should be and how they can serve community needs and have all these like wraparound services, like, you know, medical services, dental services, jobs, training, and, you know, all of these things for parents as well, not just for kids. It really, these were like community hubs. So I did that. You know, I also worked with the Boston Public Schools on redesigning schools for the year 2030, like really projecting, well, what is education going to be like, you know, decade and a half from now or more? And, you know, how does our real estate portfolio need to change to really support the future of education? And then I had a grant from the Boston Society for Architects, where I was working with a particular school, the Blackstone School in Boston. It was a turnaround school that had a lot of academic troubles, had an underserved community, and helping them redesign their campus for better education outcomes. And then, you know, as soon as I left Harvard, I started getting even more projects in education. One of the first ones where I traveled for it, I went to Australia. This was like in the middle of nowhere, like suburban Australia, halfway between Sydney and Melbourne, in a town called Wodonga. And I was designing a middle school, helping them redesign a middle school there. And that was like one of my first milestone projects.
And what did you design for them? How did you kind of think outside the box for what a middle school should be?
Yeah, well, you know, it was funny. I did a lot of research, months and months of research on their community. In fact, I lived with the school principal. I wanted to see what his life was like. I spent so many days on campus doing very, you know, this sort of technique from anthropology is the ethnographic studies, where you're basically just like a fly on the wall. You know, I did that so I could see through the lens of a student, through the lens of a teacher, through the lens of an administrator, parent, and really put myself in their shoes and be able to empathize and design with that empathy. You know, and so what I came up with for them, it was a restructuring of their campus where, instead of, you know, kids shuttling from, you know, a math class to a science class to a history class, that teachers would actually move with students, with groups of students. And it was, they wanted to design things. Kids would have the ability to go from a classroom, which is more like direct instruction, to a studio space where they could work, to specialty lab spaces. If they wanted to like record something, there was like green screen room and recording studio. If they wanted to build something, there was maker space, there was outdoor areas to get messy. And so there was you know, there were certain areas that were great for discussions and the sort of Socratic debates and discussions. And so they had this diversity of learning environments, not just like your generic, like, okay, like here's a box that's for math. And the only reason you know it's for math, because there's these like laminated posters with fractions on the walls. But then the room next door, which is for science, is like completely identical, except it's got science posters. But, you know, so it was giving them those types of diverse environments where kids could like really thrive and take on this design thinking curriculum. And then also like providing for the needs of the community. It was like a very blue collar town. So we added, you know, dental and medical services on campus. We added, you know, a computer lounge where parents could come and learn, you know, and take computer classes and get help with their resumes and jobs. And, you know, so we added things like that to get parents more involved on campus, and hopefully therefore more involved in their kids' education. And then we also, you know, I figured out that, like, you know, the school said, well, we want a performing arts center. And I said, look, like, I've done the research. I've mapped out your town. There's your city of Wodonga has built a world-class performing arts center that's a 15-minute walk away from your school. And it's never being used. You know, it's used, like, for events, like, a couple times a month. So why wouldn't you just build a partnership? So I even helped broker meetings and like this relationship between the school and the city to say, hey, let's not build redundant infrastructure. Let's actually forge alliances and start to utilize the infrastructure that you've already built in the city. You know, so it was things like that. You know, we there was an elementary school right across the street, and I said, look, like if you and them, you know, if you find a way to stagger your schedule like this, and you could share that gymnasium, then we free up your gymnasium and desert, and there's no response within a 15-minute walk of this community. And so why don't we turn this into a canteen where there's going to be local, you know, food vendors and food trucks and stands that can take over your gym, and that becomes a buzzing spot in the evenings and throughout the day. Even parents can come for lunch. So it's all these things that, like, at first glance you'd never think, like, oh well, this is part of education, because obviously, like, you know, typically a designer comes in and says, cool, like, how many kids you got? All right, I'm going to divide that by 25, and that's the number of classrooms you get, and I'm going to throw in a gym and a library and a cafeteria, and voila, like, there's your school. But for me, it was like, no, these schools, this is like social infrastructure. This is stuff to help the community, to help the kids. And so, like, what else can a school do? Like, when I did the ethnographic studies with kids, I realized, like, majority of these kids aren't eating breakfast. Like, whether it was because they had, you know, blue collar families that just, like, their parents left early in the morning, they didn't have money for it, whatever it was, majority of these kids weren't eating breakfast. And so it's like, how can you expect kids to nourish their minds when their bodies aren't nourished, right? Like, we've got to take care of their basic needs first. They got to have food, shelter, water, like, security. We've got to make sure they've got all these things before we expect them to, like, achieve any sort of greatness. And so, you know, I think that's, you've got to design with your eyes open, right? Yeah. You've got to really look at, and that's what goes back to, like, when I was talking about, you know, not being a formalist. Like, if you just go in there saying, like, I'm going to make this amazing sculpture that everyone in the world's going to look at it and know, like, oh, that's a, you know, that was done by this architect. No, like, who's that helping? You know, like, how many Guggenheims can you have in the world where it's like, okay, this is going to help, like, drive tourism. Okay, fine. But what about the other 99.9% of architecture that exists in the world? You know, you've really got to design with your eyes open and think through these things. And then as architects, are we doing a service to humanity, which is, in my mind, like, why our profession exists, right? Like, even if you think back to the first architecture in the world, it was probably a fence, right? Or it was a wall, a roof. Like, it was these basic things that were, like, providing for the needs for humans. And you look at architecture today and it's like, well, we've got almost 8 billion people in the world and we're not doing a very good job of providing for them. And neither is as an industry. I mean, like, the things we talk about and celebrate, you know, if you look at magazines today, the top, like, design publications, they're too busy talking about, like, oh my gosh, this architect just did a house with a curved wall. And it's like, so what? Like, what does that do? Like, tell us why we should care about that. Otherwise, like, let's not talk about those things. Like, that doesn't help anyone. Frankly, like, until we stop doing that, until we stop making it so much about art and we stop talking about, look how pretty this is, the general public's going to continue thinking of us as, you know, this luxury item. But once we stop, once we say, look, We're designing with our eyes open. We are solving problems. We are using design for good. We are building things that make people's lives better. Then the public will give us that respect. Then the public and global leaders will call us to the conversation table. Then we'll be able to actually have some sort of status where we can help the world and be in those positions. And, you know, frankly, it's on us. It's incumbent on designers and the media that covers design to kind of move past the superficial and really think about purpose and meaning in the work.
So you took your experience with education to a different level, so to speak, with Black Girls Code and also Code Next Lab. How did you, did Google reach out to you? Tell us the background of how that all came to be.
Yeah, Google did reach out. It's kind of funny because, you know, until that point, I had only been a consumer, a user of Google. You never think, you know, your web search web search platform's going to reach out to you one day and say, hey, we need some help. But, you know, they saw, and I think a lot of Silicon Valley sees this, but Google really took this initiative after they saw, look, like we don't have a lot of diversity in tech. That's a problem. Like we should be creating products that serve all of humanity. And how can we do that if our people aren't reflective of that wide spectrum of users and you know, and understands those needs closely? So, you know, they wanted to diversify the pipeline that's coming into the tech sector. And so they turned to education and they said, well, let's start as early as eighth grade and give opportunities and exposure to kids that are from these communities, you know, African American community and Latin community that are underrepresented in tech, specifically in hotspots like Oakland and New York, where you know, it's in the Bay Area and New York City, where Google has big offices, and yet, you know, the kids are so close to the tech world and yet so far away because their schools aren't teaching them computer science, or maybe they don't even have computers at home, or maybe their parents aren't computer savvy, you know, Google reached out. They asked me to come by their New York office to chat about this. You know, we had done a lot of work with New York City public schools and that demographic. And so they were really interested in our process as well of how we involve, you know, the learners and really get to understand the needs of these communities, these underserved communities, and designing for them, especially for, you know, people of color. And so, you know, they called us. So, you know, it was a great experience working on that. We've worked on so many campuses since that first Code Next, you know, expanding even into the university level and that age of young adults, and helping them, you know, also be able to compete with, you know, the kids. You know, I think Silicon Valley still uses like your university as a proxy, for like whether your resume ends up in the yes or no pile. I think sometimes the companies are still doing that, right? And so they're looking at did you go to the Stanfords and the Carnegie Mellons and the MITs and, you know, Georgia Techs, and you know, and so like, how do you help these kids that are at community colleges or HBCUs or Hispanic serving institutions and just these overlooked talent pools? How do you give them a leg up? How do you help them, you know, compete? How do you help them get noticed? How do you help them break into that ecosystem? And so, you know, again, it's really about, you know, getting these underrepresented groups into the tech world.
Right. And how did you design for that? What was your process and what were your results? What did you end up creating?
Well, so for Code Next Lab, you know, there were a couple of key objectives. So one was that kids needed access. So immediately, you know, that told us like, look, this needs to be in their neighborhoods. This is not like hey, you need to come to Google's campus for this, or it's going to be, you know, down in Silicon Valley, because immediately that creates an access problem. So that was one. Another was the, you know, a lot of people in tech especially talk about imposter syndrome. And so these kids, you know, how do you get them to feel like they belong? Because when you look in the media, or these kids look in the media, who does the media show them when they say, like, you know, this is who's in tech? Well, you see Elon Musk and Zuckerberg and Bill Gates, and, you know, no one that looks like these kids, right? And so they just, you know, there's that imposter syndrome can start as early as, you know, childhood, where you feel like, well, I don't belong. Like, I don't see anyone that looks like, you know, maybe I'm just not the right fit. Like, this is not for me. And so, you know, when they walk into the Codex lab, these kids, we've really celebrated around the lab the stories of Black and Latin inventors and scientists and technologists, and those like seminal moments and incredible milestones and achievements of these individuals. So, for example, like even in the kitchen pantry snack area for the kids, there's the story of Guillermo Gonzalez Camarena, who is this Mexican inventor who created color television in the 1940s, right? Like who would have known that like the inventor of color TV is Mexican, right? For these kids, it's affirmation that look, someone who looks like me, someone who comes from a similar background as me has made significant contributions in tech, and so can I. So, you know, there was that issue of the confidence. There was also the issue of like, and this was straight from the mouths of, you know, the program managers that said, you know, a lot of these kids, like in these communities, they grow up and the cool thing to do is like become an entertainer, right? Like you want to be the next Jay-Z or the next LeBron James. Like those are the things that seem cool, but how can we make it cool to be a scientist? How can we make it cool to be a technologist, a programmer? Like, how do we make this cool? And so for, you know, for me, that was, okay, well, we've got to show kids that it's relevant to their lives. So, for example, a couple things that we've got in the lab, we took a pair of Beats headphones, you know, all these kids like love the Beats headphones. So we basically took them apart and created an art display that talks about wearable technology and all the little bits and pieces that go into that, so these kids can realize, like, wow, that's cool. Like, man, I could 3D print some of these parts, or I could laser cut this, or, you know, I could make a pair of headphones. We've also got a display, an interactive display, talking about printed circuit boards and how those have been inside of game controllers dating back to, you know, Atari and even, you know, back in the 80s until now. And so we're showing kids, like, look, computer scientists actually influence the way you play. And so, you know, they're starting to see the relevance. Like we've also got areas explaining how Neymar, a Brazilian soccer player, how he has sensors embedded in his soccer ball to help him track performance. So again, like relating to the things that these kids, like in pop culture, that these kids care about, and showing them like, hey, you can make this stuff, you can make it cooler, you can make it better. You know, computer scientists have created this stuff for you. So the relevance piece was big. Another thing that we wanted to do is get kids into a constructivist mindset. So getting them thinking like makers, right? Not afraid to try things, take on challenges. It's okay to make mistakes and really start to see their built world as things that are made, a built and digital world, of course. And so we did a couple of things. Like we think back to, I love the Pompidou in Paris by Rogers and Renzo Piano, where they've really exposed the guts of how it works. And so we did that for the kids here, where they could see, you know, okay, like, wow, behind these walls or ceilings, like there's all these pipes and ducts and, you know, all of these things, the guts of the building that make it work. So, you know, we also had, between a couple of the classrooms, we had these sliding barn doors, and we decided to make them out of clear plexiglass to expose the framing inside so kids could see, okay, this is how it's made. Huh. In fact, every single window that we created inside the space, I made sure that we had exposed screws so the kids could see how the glass and the window frame come together and how that's, you know, inserted into a wall. So there's so many areas throughout where there's little details, little touches, you know, obvious. It might not hit them on day one, but as they spend a few weeks, a couple months in that space, they may look up or look around them and just have this aha moment or this moment of curiosity of like, huh, I never noticed that screw, or like, oh, okay, I see, like there's this structure inside this barn door that's like helping it move or keeping it up. Like I never thought about that. And you know, these little moments that will get kids to think about how things are made.
Yeah, no, for sure. And what's next? You are also working on a pretty interesting project in India too, relating to education. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So we've working on our second project now. You know, we recently completed the design. This was maybe 2 years ago, of the Riverbend School, which is I guess people online are calling it the School for Happiness.
Oh, really? That's an awesome title.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, really what the school focuses on is the social and emotional well-being of kids and their happiness. You know, the founders are not educators, and so they were coming from different industries, and so they weren't held back by this like inertia of what education should be. So they really questioned things and looked at it from a high level, you know, 30,000 foot level, and said, look, content, which is what most schools care about, right? If you look at schools around the world today, it's like, oh, we're just going to cram these kids' heads with content. Content is easy to get. Like, you can get that on Khan Academy. You can get that on YouTube. You can get it online. Like, it's really easy to get content these days. So let's not like put our entire focus on content. Instead, let's focus on the things that matter in life, which is like, are you actually happy in your life? Like, when you're 60 and you look back on your life, or you're 70, or even currently as a child, like, what matters most is like your happiness, right? Otherwise, like, why are you doing any of the things that you're doing in this world? And so if you're not happy, like, what's kind of like, what's the point, right? Where's the joy in living? And so they said, let's focus on that. So we designed this entire campus around happiness, as that being the priority more than like academics or test scores. And I mean, India's already got such issues with like students committing suicide and high stress rates and anxiety, because like literally you've got a billion people competing against each other, right? And academically, like, that can be extremely stressful. And so it's sort of a reprioritization on like what matters in our lives, what's really important.
You know, what kind, when you hear, you know, somebody say it's the school of happiness, or the, you know, that kind of response, I mean, what, how does that make you feel? I mean, is that true success? Is that, you know, what you started out trying to do? You know, tell me how that feels, and, you know, how you want to continue to do this down the line and in the future.
So Riverbend was an incredible design experience. We had such creative freedom from the client. We were able to really design what we as designers felt like was the best solution for their problem, for what they were trying to achieve. And for me, it's definitely a true mark of success in that, you know, construction's just started, and even before this thing's built, it's ignited this global discourse on education. I mean, for the last 2 years, you know, since we really published Riverbend, people all over the world have been talking about it. I mean, the day you wake up and you see that Arianna Huffington tweeted about your project is pretty cool.
Yeah. it's almost, you know, as good of a day as when Google calls you.
That's right. Yeah. And you know, when you see the CEO of Unilever talking about, yes, they're like, this should be the future of education. And, you know, it's, I think what's great is that it's, even before it's built, it's shifting people's minds. It's getting people to rethink, like, what are we doing? Like, why are we sending kids to school for this many hours a week? Like, is it literally just to pass tests and then come out and be like corporate cogs? Like, what, you know, is this what we want for them? Is this worth like all this investment and time and energy? And for example, even now with COVID, right, a lot of schools opening, like, my first thought is, well, is it even worth putting our kids in harm's way or at risk, right? Like, school better be damn good and better be worth it. Like, they better be learning and they better be developing into great people. Otherwise, like, why would I send my kid there with, you know, this potential risk factor? And so, you know, I think with Riverbend, just that conversation that was started, you know, around the world on this topic of like, what is the goal of education? What are we trying to do? And what type of people do we want to develop and cultivate and create, essentially, and send out into the world, right? Do we want happy people that are going to go do good in the world? Or do we just want people that have memorized a bunch of stuff to pass a bunch of tests about stuff that they don't care about, who are then like completely lost, trying to figure themselves out? And by the way, like, we're stressed and anxious the whole time.
Right. No, and I mean, you know, if you look at the school, and I'm looking at your website as we talk, but I mean, it makes complete sense, right? Like, why don't we approach education this way, right? Like, you have a meditation deck and lake, you have pet stables and farming, you have, dormitories that are built in, you know, a style that, you know, encourages community. There's pavilions throughout the way. You know, there's a Zen garden. I mean, who wouldn't want to go to school here? I mean, why do you think it has taken this long for us to start thinking about education the way we do, you know, many, you know, as you took lessons in urban planning and master communities and, you know, why don't we look at schools that way? Is it just been space or just been, you know, legacy? You know, what do you think has been the holdup on thinking outside the box? And to that effect, how do you think, or do you think people will start thinking differently because of COVID?
I think legacy is a big part of it, right? If you look at the school buildings in the U.S., you know, they're all based on this industrial model where the goal was to crank out factory workers or just crank out compliant workers, right? Not thinkers. They're just like worker bees. And so it was very much like, we're just going to drill information into your head. You're just going to sit there and take it. And you know, that's absolutely not what the world needs today. And I would go out on a limb to say there's probably very few people in the world that say, yes, that's what I want my life to be. And so, you know, I think legacy is part of it. You know, there's, of course, like I could speak for educators in the U.S., like they're so highly regulated too, right? Like I meet teachers who are literally afraid to try anything different because they have to teach, like they have to teach the test because their jobs depend on it, right? So like we're really not even setting up teachers for success, right? By overly regulating. And the good news is there's a lot of people that are questioning it now and are starting to create micro schools and independent schools and charter schools and even learning centers. We just designed a learning center down in Florida in Delray Beach, which is essentially it's the co-work kids who are schooled. You know, this was after the Parkland school shootings. There were a lot of kids who moved to homeschool. They felt safer. So, you know, where do they come to socialize? Where do they get tutoring and extra help? And then also kids who go to school, like after school, this is a place for them to come, be social, learn. There's like, you know, coaches floating around like you'd have at the Genius Bar in an Apple store. And so like all these beautiful, and this was, you know, even pre-COVID, like this idea came up. I think it's even more relevant, maybe in a sort of COVID world. So all these beautiful things like sprouting up around the world in terms of education. And so for us, that's what we want to design, right? We want to help those visionaries who are coming up with new models and challenging the status quo and saying, no, like the old way doesn't work. Like we're not going to settle for that. We don't want to torture our kids and put them through that. We're not, you know, those are the people that I want to partner with and design for and help create those models that the rest of the world can look at and say, wow, like that, I want to send my kids there. Like that's how it should be. And then they can start to model that in their own communities.
From a mom of three who just found out that her kids aren't going back to school this afternoon and are homeschooling, I totally agree. I mean, I think in this new world, you know, we're going to have to, we should be thinking differently and, you know, have to think differently. And, you know, I'm excited that you have been thinking about it, you know, in these ways the last, you know, call it since, you know, 10 years. So, what's next for you? What do you still want to do? You know, you said that you wanted to start with one thing, education. You know, are you looking to expand out? Are you looking to do different things, or are you really happy in the education space? Because it might be more relevant now than ever, and happiness is something we'll all need as everyone goes back to school.
Right. Well, I've already started that expansion out. I realized in doing so many of these education projects that we were also tackling other things. We were tackling social justice issues. We were tackling environmental issues, poverty, wellness. And so now, you know, I'm looking at projects that essentially tackle the world's biggest problems, whether that is, you know, how we treat each other, how we live, how we treat the planet, you know, how we care for women, immigrants, you know, people of color, like the opportunities that they have, like, you know, are we living in sustainable ways? Are we helping, you know, create equal opportunities? Are we trying to eradicate poverty? Are we making sure that like everyone has food and water and safety? So there's just so many issues that we're starting to look at now. And you know, it all happened because so much of education also ties into these things. And you know, like I was saying earlier, the Amazon model where, you know, okay, we started with the books, right? We started with education, and it's now I feel comfortable and I feel like it's time. I mean, there's so many, you know, if we look in our country alone with Black Lives Matter and just like how hard like that community has struggled for so many years to just be treated equally. And as designers, like we can absolutely help with that, right? We can be a part of that fight. We can make things better. We can design just cities and places that uplift and help these communities that for so long have been like, you know, kept out of these opportunities and not given the fair chance. So, you know, I'm starting to look at so much more now beyond education.
No, that's wonderful. And on your website, it says, you know, sponsor a project, design your own. So do you find people to help make some of these, you know, projects possible? You know, just looking at it, there's a Black Art Center, there's a Women's Accelerator, there's a Literacy Lounge, a 3D printed school in India. I mean, do you find people to help make some of these projects a reality? Because, you know, funding must be an issue for some of this.
We do. And so, you know, while we still take on a few clients here and there, by and large, what we're doing is we are finding the communities in need and finding problems that need addressing, designing solutions for those, and then finding individuals or companies or groups or foundations that align with that cause, you know, that care about immigrants or women's rights or social justice or education or environment. Finding those people that are willing to fund these projects, you know, there's so many dollars that are contributed to these causes. And a lot of times it goes towards programs and other things, but why not architecture? Like why, you know, so really what we're offering is tangible and concrete ways to put your money towards these causes that you care about. And also helping people connect the dots and see that architecture actually does impact education. Architecture does impact social justice. Architecture does impact the environment and poverty and all of these causes. So, you know, we're finding funders to support and back these architectural projects.
Throughout your, I mean, you have such wonderful and amazing ideas and insights and. Was there someone along the way, a mentor, a person, you know, somebody that, you know, helped you figure out which way to go or made sure you were on the right track? Or, you know, was this just something that was instilled from you from an early age?
So many. It's hard to even count how many people influence us in our lives, you know. Obviously it starts with your parents and then your local community and you know your sort of cultural and ethnic communities and those values, or even like your, you know, fellow immigrant community I've had such fantastic people. I've been truly fortunate of just the people that have come into my life. And you know, one thing that really stands out to me in all these years, that this is when I was in Los Angeles, when I was working at Meyer's office. And there was a gentleman, he was a professor at Pepperdine at the time, and he attended my mosque. And, you know, I was talking to him one day, and it was like I was feeling lost at the time, especially because, you know, as I mentioned, like the work at Meyer's office, like I didn't necessarily feel like that was what I wanted to do with architecture. And, you know, he said to me, Danish, it's okay to step off the path and take a moment to think about where you're headed and what you're doing. It was a reminder to me that people are just on this path and going fast, like just trying to get somewhere, zoom, zoom, zoom. And they're like zipping by you. And everyone just like seems to be in this like rat race all the time where it's like, okay, I'm going to graduate. And then I'm going to get this, like, I'm going to try to land this awesome job. And then I'm going to try to make a lot of money and then have the white picket fence and then just like do that. And which is fine. Like that works for some people and that's totally valid. But it was a reminder to me that like don't feel like you're going to get left behind just because you stopped to reflect and you got off the path, sidestepped, you paused and you held there for a moment and you thought about, where is it that I want to go? What do I want to do? Which to me, actually, there was this incredible commencement address that Steve Jobs gave at Stanford. I think this is while, I was still, in my early 20s and I remember listening to this. And he basically said, this thing that we call life around us, and I'm going to butcher this and I'll do no justice to how Steve put it, but he said this thing like we call life, this is just made up essentially, right? These like societal structures that tell you should do this or that, like people no smarter than you and I made those decisions. Like if you don't like it, if you think there's a better way, if you don't want to live that way, then screw it. Like go live how you want to live, like design your own life. And so that to me, even though that wasn't direct advice to me, I mean, things like that really stand out to me of like, look, like we don't have to take the world as a given the way it is, right? The status quo, these are all decisions that other people made. Like if things suck, like if education sucks, let's change it, right? If it's not doing what we think it needs to be doing, let's change it.
No, that's so great. And we always end this podcast with the title of it, what I've learned, but I'm guessing that has been your greatest lesson learned along the way, unless there's been another one.
It's that like we have the power to change things in the world. Like we don't have to just accept them the way they are. And we don't have to do things the way everyone else does, yeah. Right? We can do things that are right for us and feel right to us. We don't have to just be blind followers or sheep. And in fact, I think that's when the world thrives is when people really start thinking for themselves and challenging, things that don't work and fixing them.
Yeah, no, I think that's so wonderful. And, such the inspiration that many need to hear right now, especially with everything going on in the world today. So thank you so much for taking the time to share your amazing work and your really, truly incredible insights. It's been such a pleasure.
Oh, it was so fun. Thanks, Stacey.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Hospitality Design's What I've Learned. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find full episodes and transcripts at hospitalitydesign.com.